I'm supposed to do the introduction?
Whenever you're ready, buddy. See, it's big responsibility.
Like, you know how we do this? I think this is like the second time I've ever done the introduction. So
we believe in you. You're gonna do so good.
It's harder than you think, isn't it?
Okay, here we go. Everyone be quiet because we're getting started. Hi, everybody. It is June 30th, 2019. This is your episode 186 of the At Percussion Podcast. My name is Ben Charles, and with me, as always, are Carly Vigna.
Hi, everyone.
And Casey Cangelosi.
Hey, everyone. Hey, Ben. Hey, Carly.
Casey, how's your summer going there?
It's going fine. So do you know, I have some Beatles history for you today. This episode comes out on July 18th. Do you want to know what the Beatles did on this day?
I have some Beatles history that a couple weeks ago I saw Paul McCartney.
But I'm talking about today. Like this is today. In 1968, they recorded something called Cry Baby Cry and Helter Skelter. Have you ever heard of that?
Yeah, I've heard of those.
Are those any good?
Yeah, Helter Skelter is the first heavy metal tune ever.
Oh, I don't know about that.
It is. Paul McCartney was accused of only writing really like sweet love songs, and so he wanted to write something really rocking and grungy sounding, so he did.
Oh, I have heard that. Actually, yeah, that does ring a bell now. Well, and Helter Skelter is what, oh my gosh, what's his crazy face?
Yeah, Charles Manson took that as his like white supremacist anthem.
Right.
Right, yeah.
Okay, so did Charlie Manson take that from the Beatles, or did the Beatles take the name from Manson? I don't know. The first one. Okay.
Yeah, Manson still. Wow. Anyway, yeah, Paul McCartney performed that a couple weeks ago, and I saw him in Dallas. Anyway.
You hardly ever mention that, Ben.
Yeah.
Yeah, you only mentioned that a few times every episode. It's good.
Yeah. Good. So anyway, today's guests are Jamie Esposito and Stephen Hall, who are the founders of the Spectrum Ensemble. Jamie and Stephen became friends while studying at Northwestern University, and their passion for LGBTQ+ representation in the classical music community drove them to form the Spectrum Ensemble. The Spectrum Ensemble's objectives are to commission great music of high caliber, increase representation of queer artists in the classical music world, and to raise funds to donate to LGBTQ+ advocacy organizations. The ensemble has done their debut concert just in May of this year. Welcome to the podcast, Jamie and Stephen.
Hi, hi.
Hi.
Happy to be here.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
So, Jamie and Stephen, how is your summer going? Any exciting plans?
No. I'm going to my lake house with my girlfriend and her kids. I'm excited for that. We're doing that in July. Awesome. I cleaned the house aggressively with my time off.
Normal people things. That's strange.
Yeah. Yeah, catching up aggressively.
I am teaching the Santa Clara Vanguard Cadets for an ensemble this summer. So that's super fun. I'm on break right now. I'm back home, but I'm going back there for like a couple weeks on July 5th. So like Friday. Yeah. Friday from now. Sorry. It'll be before this podcast comes out, but yeah.
Hey, can we ask you all about that premiere concert you did? I think it was back in May, and it was called Something Light, right?
A New Light.
New Light, that's right. And you highlighted Bernstein, and you highlighted
Barber, yeah.
Thank you. along with a bunch of new commissions.
Yeah. Stephen, you want to take it, or you want me to take it?
You can take it.
Okay. Fill in if you need to.
Yeah, I will.
So we started this process like back in August, I would say, in terms of like the first thing we did was like booked a space. And then once we like booked a space, we like knew we had to put on a concert. So that was like the first thing we did, because then we had a place, we had a goal, we had a time. And then we kind of like on Facebook, we asked like who are queer composers that we know, and we started like a little database. And from that, we kind of just listened to all the names we were given and kind of picked people that we like the music, stuff like that. We also wanted to make it inclusive to Denton because that's where we did our concert and that's where we're saying our home base is. So we got two UNT students we asked them to commission some pieces or to write some pieces for us. And that was Luke Ellard, who's getting his DMA right now at the University of North Texas. And Kevin Rosias, how do you say his name?
Rosasia.
Rosasia. And he's an undergrad at University of North Texas. So they were asked to premiere, and that was cool. And then we also asked LJ White, who also went to Northwestern, and just mutual friends, we knew about him. And then our fourth one was Derek Tywanuk, who Steven knows personally. I do not, but he was our fourth commission. And then LJ White's commission was actually, he wrote for this piece, is called Cog. It was originally for four percussionists, and Third Coast actually premiered it back when they were in their master's program together at Northwestern, I think. And then he rewrote it for two percussionists for us. What else you got, Steven?
Yeah, basically we couldn't afford to, we couldn't afford LJ for a whole new piece, so we just had him arrange one of his existing pieces, and it turned out really well. It was so exciting. So yeah.
I had a question about Derek, because I don't know Derek personally, but we've sort of chatted some through Facebook, and I know Derek has written a piece for our friend Brian Calhoun, and I remember Derek telling me, like, in depth about, like, the notes he had about, like, Brian's style of playing. Brian does a lot of marimba voice. Brian's also, I think, 6'6", so he has a big wingspan. Right. So it sounded like Derek was very into sort of customizing a piece for a performer. Did he work with you guys on your sort of customization, and what were those tailor fits that he made for you?
Kind of. It was a surprise. I'm, like, very into drag culture. Like, I love it. It's my go-to thing that I watch that makes me happy. Like, RuPaul's Drag Race. It's just so funny watching men get so mad about not being the best woman. It's just so funny. It's like the best cross between America's Next Top Model and what would you say the other one is? It's like too specific. Oh, you don't watch it, Steven.
Project Runway.
Yeah. Runway. Thank you. Right. So it combines those two things, and the makeup's actually like phenomenal that these men are doing, and like it's cool. And it empowers women mostly. Like, look at how sexy I am as this beautiful woman. You can also be this sexy, beautiful woman in your own skin. So it's like, it's great. I love RuPaul's Drag Race. I posted a lot on Instagram, and then he casually dropped, he like sent us the piece, and it was covered in drag. It was like covered in drag throughout the piece, in terms of we had a movement where I really like this piece also. I was so excited when he wrote us this piece. We had a movement of fan work, which is specific to drag culture. Not only, but like they do a lot, and a lot of words were taken from the queer community, like oh, krrr, and yas. So we got to say that during the piece, which was pretty quick, hip. And then Steven got to do a death drop, which like I've never seen anyone do except drag. Yes, Steven, yes.
So we had like rhythmic stuff with the fans, and we were like playing rhythms with one hand and doing fans with the other hand. So that was really fun.
I saw a video on Facebook. Hopefully that didn't happen. I saw a video on Facebook of you guys like kind of like working with them, like with a metronome or something. And then, yeah, obviously the picture we used for the episode was that piece for sure.
Steven got along with the fan more than I did. It like straight sliced me when it fell out of my hand one day. It was like a terrible paper cut. Yeah, like what? What? Yeah.
It's like who thought that we would have been having to practice rhythmic fanning or fan flipping?
Absolutely
or something, whatever you would call that. I guess one of the things that comes up as a percussionist. It's fun.
It brings to mind that there's that quote from Steve Schick in his book, and I'm going to butcher it now, but basically he said, when I was a student, I would walk down the hall listening to the clarinetists practice their Brahms and the violinists practice their Bach, and then I would go back into my practice room and try and figure out how to bow a cowbell underwater.
Underwater, right? Those fans, it reminds me, there's this piece called Solar Myth that Jew Percussion Group have, and it's sort of marimba spiritual setup, so marimba solo and there's three percussionists, but the whole introduction, they've got these amazing red fans that make that exact sound Steven just did. You swap them out and they sound really aggressive, and they're thick and they're heavy, and you can beat bass drum with it. Literally one of the coolest pieces I've ever seen, Solar Myth.
The unofficial name for the sound is Thorpe.
Thorpe. Oh, I was close. Gotcha. Yeah, if you're listening, watch this on YouTube. We have visuals.
I think that's actually the official name.
Thorpe?
Yeah. Thorpe.
Of the sound. It's like, I'll use this moment to educate. There's a YouTube channel. It's called UNHHHHH. And it's two drag queens, Trixie and Katya, who just have like a YouTube channel, and it's absolutely hysterical. And one of them constantly use a fan, and their video editors are also incredible. And they started saying Thorpe every time she opened her fan. Thorpe, Thorpe, Thorpe. And then they coined it and sold it and made money from it.
Wow, I had no idea. Ben, the answer to your question is yes, by the way.
What question?
We should have done this podcast.
Oh, yeah. That was, for again, for anyone that's been a long-time listener of the podcast, you'll know that we have a text chat going that we use to sort of coordinate things and mostly make jokes to try and distract each other. Oh, and I wrote in the text chat when Jamie started talking, I said, Casey, we should have done this podcast and drag, missed opportunity.
That would have been perfect.
Start over.
I would have been excited. Very excited.
Casey's wearing the heels he got from Brian, though.
Yeah, you can't see him out of frame. But...
He gave you heels for real?
No, not for real.
Oh, come on.
Carly, I think you were going to say something, right?
Yeah, I wanted to ask a little bit more generally about all of the pieces that you guys commissioned. Can you talk a little bit about how the process of commissioning composers has been for you? Like, do you like to ask for specific maybe themes or instrumentation or, you know, dramatic elements or anything like that? Or do you leave it open to what the composers have in mind?
So for this process, and I think I don't want to put words in your mouth, Jamie, but for me, at least, it was the first time I've ever been involved in like the whole process of commissioning a piece. So like we both went into it like not really knowing what it was going to be like. But we didn't, in the end, give them anything besides instrumentation to work with. We said, like, we love your music that we've seen. We just want you to, like, write something for us that we will be able to play with these instruments. But we want your sort of style to shine. And, like, maybe here are some pieces of yours that we found that we liked. But don't, like, you aren't married to that idea, you know? And it turned out that three of the four of them wrote pieces that were like queer themed, but we totally didn't prescribe that at all. I mean, it's sort of like in our ethos or whatever of our group, but that was just sort of a coincidence. And it turned, I think it complemented our program really well. But yeah, there was no, I don't know, really specific things, at least that I remember. Do you remember any more, Jamie?
No, I didn't. We asked another group to see what like their contracts looked like in terms of let's hold you to this. And we even put in our contract, like, check in with us every couple months, let us know how it's going. And they really didn't, which was fine. Everyone hit their deadline, which was really cool. And then like, because we're in, I'm in Denton, I was able to meet with some of the guys when we were, doing promotional stuff on our Facebook. We did some interviews, and like with Luke specifically, I remember him showing me the piece and be like, does this make sense notation wise? But other than that.
Yeah. And I met with Derek also here in LA and, and he didn't have like anything written down at that point. It was like maybe a month before, or I'm sure he had stuff written down, but it was all written down that he like. To me, but yeah, it was maybe a month before the deadline, but he was able to like explain the whole like idea behind the piece, or at least the direction that he was going in, and it was really exciting, and I was like, yes, go do more.
Did you find that your critique of the pieces was really heightened and strong and rigorous because there was this cause behind it? It's like, well, if the pieces are supposed to represent an unrepresented group, the pieces need to be really, really strong. Did you feel that?
I know. I just, like, right. Fingers crossed that they ended up good. Uh-huh. Like, we took risks. Like, we asking an undergrad to write for us, that was, like, a risk. Sure. But I think, like, from what I saw, because we had a lot of non-musicians there, too, people from the queer community, a lot of family came, and, like, everything was really well-received. Yeah. Really well received, and like a lot of it was tonal, which absolutely helps. Mm-hmm. But
and like, I don't know, it's part of what is so cool about it is not necessarily that like the piece has to be the next masterwork that people are going to be performing for generations or something. It's that we're putting out more material by these musicians that's representing them. That's these composers and musicians that are representing our community, and so. You know, not everything is going to be perfect. We didn't really expect that going into.
And you're really clever to include Bernstein and Barber in there. like, hey, well, even if we didn't dig up some masterworks, right. guess what? If you didn't know, we already have them, you know?
Yeah.
For Bernstein and Barbara, did you guys arrange or did someone arrange for you? What exactly did you do with those?
So I arranged the Bernstein, which I didn't put my name or anything on it, and we're not like selling it or anything because I don't know what rights and stuff are for that. But yeah, I arranged that. It was like a little fun thing. And then the Barber was an existing arrangement by Nancy Zaltzman that we performed.
Right.
So with a piece like Derek's, like Dorothy Fragments, there were clearly like so many dramatic instructions and just like a whole component of acting to the piece. Did that surprise you? Is that something like kind of music you've worked with before, or was it kind of brand new?
He made sure. He asked us two questions. He asked, are you okay with theatrical things, and can you roll your R's? Those were the two questions he asked us. And we said
yes. That's important.
Yeah. And we said yes to both. And we were worried, specifically if we had to memorize it, that it would take a lot longer than we were given the allotted time. But other than that, I mean, I'm a ham. So, like, I'm into the acting thing. And then, Steven, you did the dancing. You did the death drop. You sold it. Yeah,
I mean, I was out of my comfort zone, but, you know, it was good. I liked
it. It's just, like, part of the gig, I think, for this one. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I thought it was very compelling.
Cool.
Are there any plans to record these pieces?
Say it again, Ben.
I said, are there any plans to record these pieces?
Yes. So we like did a first recording. Like I had one of my, I work at LD Bell High School for the marching band season here in Texas. And the sound guy there came and did our sound, like he recorded audio and video. So we have some of these up from the actual performance on YouTube, on our Spectrum Ensemble channel. And we're not all of them are up yet. We have one more to post. But I think that's like a long-term goal that we want to create a video inventory of queer music. And then this is just like a side note. I went in the early stages of planning all of this, I got in contact with Andre. I'm going to screw up his last name, Andre Dowell. He's in Michigan, and I was able to go to this Sphinx conference, and it was specifically, I want to look it up because I don't want to be wrong, but it's this organization that helps people in, Stephen, can you help me? You know what it was.
Wasn't it Communities of Color?
Communities of Color, yeah, and it was like a music program. It just like helps in Detroit get kids started early. And once a year they hold a conference. And I think even Rob Knopper came and talked about it. Yeah, Rob Knopper came this year for
like start organizations and stuff, sort of like what we're doing. So it was sort of perfect for.
Yeah. And so when I was walking around, people would say like, oh, we have this inventory. We have this inventory. And it was like African-American posers inventory. It was Latinx inventory. And I would go up to these people and I would be like, oh, do you also say like who's queer? And everyone would be like, oh no, we're not adding that. And like, why not? It is something that is important to like why, or just like another reason our music is the way it is. You know what I mean? So I think long-term, it would also be smart to start an inventory of queer music, just as a category to put it out there that it is happening.
Well, the resources are so important because we talk to guests all the time that they advocate for this. They want to play more female composers. They want to play more minorities. And it's just a question. I mean, every time we've mentioned a list or some resource, everyone's like, oh, what is that again? Let's write that down. You know, everyone is kind of keeping track. Well, I shouldn't say everyone, but a lot of people are keeping track. You know, there's a lot of interest in that, you know, and just, yeah, programming diversity for sure.
And you know what, like going into it, we were surprised that something like what we're doing doesn't already exist. You know, it seems like right now in our world, this is the time for it. And we were like looking for groups, and there's some out there that are like LGBT, and you know, there's all the like the gay choruses and stuff in a lot of cities and things like that. But there's not really that much. So we were like, let's do it. But yeah, it was surprising that it's not.
A huge part of it, I feel, is a fault of classical, just the popularity of classical and modern music. You know, I mean, I talked about that little Beatles history segment, and I've got a few others for you, just like what happened this day, July 18th in history. And man, it is really hard to find that in classical music. You can find birth dates and death dates. And of course, if you, you know, you go search for a specific date in a specific article, I mean, you may find it. But if you just look up, like, what Jimi Hendrix did on this day, you'll find it. But if you look up what Beethoven did on this day, you won't find it. You know, it's just like, yeah. So anyway, those resources are really valuable.
Yeah.
Well, I had a topic kind of relevant to what we're talking about now. So I guess there's no time like the present to talk about this. So I wanted to actually highlight an LGBT composer, and that is one that many of us are probably already familiar with, and that is Lou Harrison. And I wanted to start out by, I found a wonderful quote by Lawrence Mass, who's an American physician and writer, about Lou Harrison. He said, "With Lou Harrison, being gay is something affirmative. He's proud to be a gay composer and interested in talking about what that might mean. He doesn't feel threatened that this means he won't be thought of as an American composer who is also great and timeless and universal." So I think that's a wonderful introduction to Lou Harrison, and I'll give my little book report on Lou Harrison now. We can maybe discuss some of his work. So Lou Harrison was born in Portland, Oregon on May 14th, 1917, and he moved to the San Francisco Bay Area as a child. It sounded like he might have bounced around quite a bit, but all in the Bay Area. And in the Bay Area, being sort of a cultural melting pot, he was exposed to Cantonese opera, Native American music, Mexican music, jazz, and classical music, which all had huge influences on his later output of works. After he graduated high school, he studied with Henry Cowell, who is another kind of icon in LGBT American music history. And he began composing for dance and percussion. At this time in the 1930s, he met a young John Cage, and the two began a concert series devoted to new music for percussion. Some of the most famous works of this era are John Cage's Third Construction was one of them, and then also Double Music from 1941. This is the work where John Cage wrote parts 1 and 3, and Lou Harrison wrote parts 2 and 4, and they had like a sort of pre-constructed set of rules about form, but other than that, they didn't confer as they were composing their individual parts. And I've heard a rumor that they actually didn't ever rehearse the parts together. They just put them together live on the concert, but I don't know if that's true or not. He moved to LA in 1942 to study with Arnold Schoenberg at UCLA. And then a year later, in 1943, he moved to New York City, where he worked as a composer and music critic. While in New York City, he befriended Charles Ives, and he brought many of Ives's works, which were previously pretty much ignored, to prominence. He edited many of them, and he conducted the first performance of Charles Ives' Third Symphony, which Ives won the Pulitzer Prize for. Ives respected Harrison so much that he gave him half of the prize money for the Pulitzer, and then also many of the times when Harrison would charge a fee to edit a work or something like that, Ives, who was actually quite well off from his insurance business, would pay Harrison beyond what he had asked. In 1947, the stress and noise of New York City led to a nervous breakdown. John Cage recommended that Lou Harrison move to Black Mountain College in North Carolina, which Harrison did, and this rural setting proved to be very productive for him. He composed many of his works there. And then in 1953, he moved back to California, where he resided for the rest of his life in the San Francisco Bay Area, where he completed many works that included new systems of tuning. So Harrison, for example, eventually got into just intonation, which, again, many of us are probably familiar with, and was sort of one of the early masters of messing around with systems of tuning. In 1961, he was invited to the East-West Music Encounter, which was a conference in Tokyo, and this spurred an interest in Asian music studies in Harrison that he would pursue for the rest of his life. He met William Kolvig in San Francisco in 1967, and he became Harrison's life partner for 33 years until Kolvig's death in the year 2000. In 1975, he met Pak Cockrell, who was a Javanese gamelan master, and he taught Harrison about gamelan music and also encouraged Harrison to build instruments. So Harrison and his partner Kolvig would go on to build several sets of gamelan instruments for the various universities Harrison taught at, including Mills College, San Jose State University, and Cabrillo College. Harrison passed away February 2nd, 2003 in Lafayette, Indiana, on the way to a festival of his music at the Ohio State University. He was also very interested in calligraphy. And if you look at his scores, a lot of them have sort of handwritten calligraphy instructions, and that's all Harrison's own hand. If you're interested in learning more about Harrison, there's a wonderful book called Composing a World, Lou Harrison, Musical Wayfarer by Alida E. Miller and Frederick Lieberman. That's a very comprehensive biography of Harrison. And in 1985, he was inducted into the PAS Hall of Fame. And the article on the PAS website was written by Frederick Fairchild. And the kind of closing quote from that is, Lou Harrison is responsible not only for providing some of the most important works in the percussion repertoire, but also for pioneering the expansion of percussion ensembles by the use of bound objects, the addition of non-Western instruments, the use of newly invented instrumental resources, and for introducing us to his sensitive, lyrical, compositional style. And a few of his notable works are Double Music, I already mentioned, from 1941, which was composed with John Cage, In Praise of Johnny Appleseed, which was composed in 1942 and lost for many years and only found a decade or two ago and republished now. His Fugue for Percussion from 1942, which explored a new way of creating a fugue without tonal material. And then one of my favorites, I actually got to see the New World Percussion Section perform the Concerto for Organ with Percussion Orchestra, which was composed between 1972 and 1973, which is a really cool work. And the organist has to have these little pads that they tap on the organ keys with. And then one other work I wanted to mention is actually a work that does not exist. William Mersch actually tried to commission a marimba solo from Lou Harrison. And at the time, I think it was the Gulf War was going on, and Harrison was a pacifist and was so disturbed by what was going on in the world that he felt he couldn't complete a work. So there was intended to be a marimba commission from Harrison that never came about. So that's Lou Harrison in a nutshell. Yeah.
Wow. Thanks, Ben. You know, there are a couple of works. I was just browsing Steve Weiss right now while we're talking. I'm trying to find what the heck we played. I've played a lot of Harrison since getting here, and yeah, Tributes to Charon, which are two movements I can't find. And there was something else we did. I thought it was the Fugue, but I looked at the music. It's not that. We did something else. So, I mean, there's a handful of stuff out there. It's printed, but it's not in, I mean, you'd expect it all to be right there, you know?
Yeah, one of the more popular ones, I actually strayed away from saying it just because it's hard to pronounce, is Song of Quetzalcoatl, I think is how you say it. And that's one.
Probably, like, yeah, I played. Yeah. That's one of the ones we did recently.
Yeah, it's really, really cool.
That's a nice one. Yeah, it's. What's some of your favorite Harrisons, you guys?
Oh jeez, I don't think I've played any of them. I just remember it was on my master's aural, like my comps. Sure. So I had to like aggressively go to the library and look up everything he did.
Yeah, the only one I can remember off the top of my head is Fugue, which is really cool. I know. My teacher from grad school, Jack Van Geem, has played quite a bit of Lou Harrison, and I think he's worked with Harrison too, just as a member of the San Francisco Symphony. So I've really loved everything I've heard, but I don't know. I don't remember names of pieces very well.
Where did you study with Jack? Was that Colburn or?
At San Francisco Conservatory.
San Francisco Conservatory. Okay. Yeah, I love Jack Van Geem.
There's a great story, and I think it's Anthony Cerrone, was performing a piece that required elephant bells. And it was a Harrison piece that required elephant bells, which are, I guess, pretty common in his music or something. And they wanted to be really authentic. So they actually called like the San Francisco Zoo and asked for elephant bells. And they sent them, and they said they opened this box, and I think they were like wooden or something like that. And they called back and they said, well, like this piece, it looks like they're supposed to be metal. And the Zoom people go, oh, you mean ceremonial elephant bells.
Right. I've said that before. That's, yeah, being a percussionist sucks. Like, what? Yeah. Like, it sucks. What the hell? Like, yeah, there's so many things like that.
Well, sure. At University of Miami, we had to order one of those wooden elephant bells, and I found it, I ordered it online from some website from Africa.
And you found it, though.
We found it. It didn't take too long to arrive, so.
I will never forget at Miami, there was a group that did third construction, and Svet was so proud, he ordered an actual jawbone, and the dress rehearsal, the guy playing it broke it.
Yes. They just break. Yeah.
Better that than during the performance.
True. Yep. I just remember that box smelled like death.
Those jawbones are really cool because those of you who don't know, like, you know, the jawbone is the authentic version of the vibra slap. Like the vibra slap's like the cheap plastic version of this. And man, I don't even think they sound very similar. But like the vibra slap is its whole new effect. But the jawbones are really cool because you can remove the teeth And if the teeth are spaced further apart, they'll vibrate more. So you can lengthen the sound of the jawbone by literally taking teeth out. And if you're next to another instrumentalist, they see a bunch of teeth lying on your tray, they're just like, oh my God, they call 911. And
you had really, to have them or something.
Yeah, wear them. Yeah.
Really quick, going back to like Ben's, all the things you just said about Cage, Colin Harrison. If you're interested in like the queer influences on percussion ensemble, Bill Solomon, he's a percussionist based in New York, did his dissertation, and it's literally called Cage, Colin Harrison, and the Queer Influences on the Percussion Ensemble from 1932 to 1943. So if you're interested, that's like available online to read.
That's great.
If you don't know Bill Solomon, he's part of a group in New York right now, or in Brooklyn, I can't remember which one, that's doing research-based queer percussion-type things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I very briefly kind of mentioned Henry Cowell and moved on, but are any of you familiar with Alan Turing, famous British computer scientist?
Yes.
This is the guy that effectively created the logic that computers that we use now are based on. And Turing was caught being gay in some capacity, and basically he was like sentenced to, I think, chemical castration and ended up committing suicide. And roughly the same time period is when Henry Cowell was caught in the act as well, and was sentenced to prison. And I think he spent like 4 years in prison because of it. Got out early, and he was ultimately, I think in 1942, he was pardoned for it. I wanted to say this, but I didn't have the hard research to prove it, but it seems like maybe Harrison went to study with Cowell, and I think Harrison might have been studying with Cowell until Cowell went to prison. I think that might have been what studies. The timeline kind of lines up, but I didn't directly read that.
So there is a movie, The Imitation Game. It's fairly recent, and it's great, and it's about Alan Turing, mathematician, and... Yeah, I knew that name. I've seen the movie, but also my dad teaches, or has taught, I don't think he still is doing right now, but a segment on cryptography. My dad's a mathematician. So yeah, Alan Turing is the guy who like broke one of the major codes for the Allies.
Enigma machine. The Nazi.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, the Enigma machine. Yeah, it's really cool and incredibly sad.
Yeah, Stephen, actually, if you're in Northern California area, the San Jose Museum of Computer History has the Enigma machine and a little thing about Turing in there. It's pretty cool.
Right. I'll take that out.
Do you guys want to know what else happened in history?
Yes.
Yeah.
Will you think of more questions? So, yeah, something else. Ooh, I like this one. And I always pick the ones that I like. Oh, also, Ben, some other Beatles news. John Lennon was kicked out of the country on July 18th. He said he has to get out, go back to London or England because he... had some marijuana charge or something. So take that. Ben loves the Beatles, by the way.
Figured something about the Beatles was important.
right. Well, you can look up like this day what the Beatles did. They'll always be news. But one of my favorite bands is Rage Against the Machine. And in 1993, Rage Against the Machine held a protest at Lollapalooza in Philadelphia, and they went out on stage completely nude except for duct tape over their mouths. They refused to play any music and simply stood for 25 minutes with the letters PMRC written across their chest. And this was, of course, represents Parents Music Resource Center. So at that time, PMRC are the people responsible for those parental advisory stickers you see on CDs to see on CDs. I don't even know if some of our really young listeners that might not even be familiar at this point. But there'd be Senate hearings on the news and things, and like Dee Snider from Twisted Sister showed up in like full makeup and hair and everything. And him, along with John Denver and Frank Zappa, opposed all this PMRC stuff on the grounds of free speech violations. And which is kind of odd to me, because like we've said before, like people claim free speech. It's like, man, dude, that doesn't protect you from... Like, it protects you from arrest. It doesn't protect you from just, like, saying whatever the heck you want, you know? Yeah. So, as much as I don't like censorship, it's, that's something that happened. And Rage Against the Machine protested it, and of course these other artists protested it. I thought it was interesting they came up with, the parents' organization came up with something called the Filthy 15. They are Prince, Sheena Easton, Judas Priest, who, by the way, Rob Halford is probably my favorite gay rock star. Man, he's awesome. Anyway, Vanity, Motley Crue, AC/DC, Twisted Sister, which is amazing.
Yes.
There were posts who weren't the song "We're Not Going to Take It," which you've all have heard, on the grounds of violence. They said there's violence in the song, which is just like, I looked up the lyrics. Like, I think they say "we'll fight" in there. They must say something else. That's all they say. It's like nothing. It's completely silly.
People get mad to get mad. That's moral of the story. People get mad to get mad. They're just creating issues.
Well, and this particular one was totally spearheaded by Tipper Gore, Al Gore's wife. So, I mean, it's also very political. You know, you want to show censorship is important to you, and you want to whatever. You want to rally political, political favor or whatever. Mm-hmm. Oh, thanks, Ben, ex-wife. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know my politics, but also on the Filthy 15.
Music eroded their marriage. Yeah.
also on the Filthy 15, Madonna, Wasp, Def Leppard, Merciful Fate, Black Sabbath, Mary Jane Girls, Venom, and Cyndi Lauper. So that was just amazing. So anyway, that happened on this day, July 18th.
What's interesting also is just like who is deciding, or like who's on that panel of that.
Yeah, certain just parent. Al Gore and his wife. That's, you know, it.
It's like, and it affects their sales of their CDs and stuff like that too. It's like, how do you know how, what is the word for when you are not... biased? How unbiased are they?
Totally biased.
Yeah,
sure.
Like who are these parents who are deciding?
Well, and I think it had quite an opposite effect. I mean, I know when I was a kid buying CDs left and right at that age, and my friends and I, if it had a parental advisory sticker on it and explicit lyrics, you thought it's like, oh cool, I'm buying something like more grown up, and you'd go for it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like you'd really, really go for it. So, but I also think it's perfectly reasonable, you know, to let parents know, like, so you don't have to listen to the whole CD and like read through the whole lyrics or whatever. Yeah. I mean, I think it's totally.
Sure. It's a fine line, though. It's like, I don't know. I agree that it should be there, but like it should be really transparent so that you can see what the process is that they're using to come up with this or something like that. I don't mm-hmm. know. Because they could have very easily censored like queer themes also, or right. you know, whatever well, was, happens to be the thing that's not okay for kids to be exposed to.
I know. They can,
you know,
on that note, in movie ratings, actually, if there's like a kiss on screen, it like triggers a certain, you know, rating, but if there's a same sex kiss, it's a higher,
right?
And so far higher. Aww. Yeah. Mm-hmm. No. Yeah. It's absolutely ridiculous. It's
C-15.
They said is based on violence, drug or alcohol use, and sexual and occult things is what their like list of standards is there in the Filthy 15.
Well, it's sort of crazy that a cult is on there also, because then it's also like a religious thing, and it's like, what religion are you aligning with then? You know, like
I know. Yeah. But, yeah, I know. And of course, it's like good old Christian values, no doubt. It's Tipper Gore. And of course, that's what it is, you know. And of course, like the parent, I know my parents, I'd bring home like my Megadeth record, you know, Megadeth record of I don't know, late 90s called Euthanasia. And it's got this cool graphic of a mom like pinning up babies on a clothesline by the toe. They're not getting hurt or anything, but like it's pretty
they're
like,
just drying.
Man, that's some heavy shit when you're 15, you know, that's pretty dang cool. And like I remember like my parents just kind of went like, oh, that's stupid. And like here, like that totally like diminishes your like, oh, I'm so rebellious and cool. And you know what I mean? And that's just how I would choose to parent, I think. I would just go like, oh, yeah, okay, that's no big deal, whatever. And then all of a sudden it's totally demystified. It's totally like, not this extreme amazing thing all of a sudden. And I think that really worked. One more thing I want to add just to this topic. I think I mentioned it once on the podcast before, but Greg Gaffin, the singer from one of my favorite bands, Bad Religion, he said once that this whole idea of a beautiful thing about music and the lyrics specifically, like having messages in lyrics tied to music, is that people get to absorb those messages on their own pace. So you very well might be listening to some song and you know the words, but you're not really, they're not really hitting you at that moment. You're just enjoying the music, and that keeps you listening, and that keeps the words in your head. And when you're ready to, you'll absorb it at your own pace and on your own time schedule, like emotional time schedule. And that's why it's so valuable to have it tied to song. Anywho, Carly, I think, right?
Yeah, changing gears a little bit. So you two have a chamber ensemble, and you're based in two different locations, right?
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about maybe some of the challenges associated with that? And of course, there are advantages too. Mm-hmm.
One thing that is great is we're both freelancers right now, so we're not like locked down to any job. So Steven was able to come a week before our performance. And we both obviously rehearsed our parts before. We like made sure we were pretty good to go. And Steven, I don't know your experience with this, but I went on tour with Heartland Marimba Festival, and that was like the same thing. It was like, learn your music. We have 4 days to put it together, and boom, we're doing it. So like I knew it like helped me personally knowing that I could do it and it was going to be fine as long as our individual parts were fine. The hardest thing, like LJ's piece Cog ended up really hard because it had a lot of hocketed rhythms, a lot of split 16th notes. So that was like, we spent so much time in my garage just like trying to figure that out slow with a metronome. So it sounded like something. So stuff like that, that was like a surprise that was pretty hard. And then on another piece, was specific, like we had to play fours, then fives, then sixes, then sevens, then back to six, then five, then three. So it was a lot of like changing hand speed type of thing, but that ended up not being a problem. Why? I don't know. But that one like wasn't a problem. So I think just like being prepared was the most important thing for both of us. Yeah. What about you, Steven?
I think we both prefer that sort of situation where like we just come in and go hardcore for like a week before the concert. It was sort of crazy because we were thinking about it and we hadn't seen each other in person for like, I think 5 years or something, but until the week before our concert. So but yeah, I mean, we just practiced our parts and we did it and it was fine. But it's also sort of cool that we can, I mean, we're sort of focusing on Texas right now, but because I'm here in California, we also have this jumping off point that we can do in the future also. So we, I don't know, it's a little bit of an advantage in a way. It's a balance of challenges and advantages.
And I think one thing just to mention about our ensemble moving forward is like, we're not set for just doing a duo. I think we want to make this as inclusive as possible as we keep going. I think it was just easy to start like this because we both don't know what we're doing. We're just trying our best as we go along. And it seems to be working. Like we've had some successful things. But I think our plan is incorporating other instrumentalists as we like start doing other commissions, like, oh, we like this piece. Or if we do arrangements or something like that. And that's when we'll start adding people onto our team, I guess.
Yeah, or at least at first we'll bring them in for like a concert or something if we have, you know, if we need that instrumentation. And then if things are working out, who knows what will happen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, like a rotating cast. Like we need.
Right.
Yeah, that's the way to do it.
No yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. If I could just interject and emphasize something that Steven said, he said, I think we prefer it that way, that we're not, you know, rehearsing together and all. And I've had this experience too with my duo partner. And it's kind of fun to have like slightly less rehearsal time than you feel like you're comfortable with, because you know at that point that you're actually relying on yourself, like you're relying on your skill set. And when you do pull it off, you kind of feel like a badass, like knowing that could have fallen apart at any point in time, but it didn't because we're better than that. I think it's like more fun that way.
And I think, well, like, woof, you have to trust your partner so much that like they're going to learn it and it's gonna be okay when I see you a week before. Like that was a big reason why I was down to work with Steven, because in our undergrad, like, I mean, this is a message to anyone in school right now, be prepared always. Steven was always prepared. Steven, like, I knew all of Steven's qualities going in, and they were, I like working with him. And we hadn't talked for 4 years. That's a separate thing to even say. You like went to Germany, you did your own thing. Maybe every once in a while I would check in and say like, hey, how are you? Hope you're doing well. But like it was in our undergrad that we met each other, that we saw how we were as performers and players and kept that in mind. And then we were willing to work with each other again a few years later.
Mm-hmm.
to just like any percussionist out there now, like don't screw up opportunities in your undergrad because they can help you later in your future.
And we like definitely, it's not like we were in our undergrad, like someday we're going to start an ensemble together or something, you know,
no.
It sort of happened.
I wasn't even like gay yet when we met originally. I was straight for most of I was gay the whole time, but I didn't realize I was gay until my like sophomore or junior year. So I was pretty late to the game of coming out.
That was great. I just thought like, oh, wait, maybe I'm gay. I could be gay.
Yeah. You might, dude. There's still hope. There's still a chance. Still hope.
Excellent, excellent. Well, I can also speak to Steven's playing because I was a judge at the PAS Marimba Competition Finals 1 year, and we gave it to Steven. So, yeah, congrats again.
I saw that performance. Did you play? Was it the one you played Merlin at?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I was there.
Yeah, it was really, really good. How do you all, you know, speaking of working apart, like we all work apart, Carly, Ben, and I, and the other co-hosts that have been on the show off and on. And I mean, a huge challenge is delegating duties. You know, you all have this great website and it's really, really easy to find everything. It looks really nice, but it's hard. I mean, it is really, it's tough to delegate duties and make sure that, you know, I'm sure Jamie doesn't want to feel like she's doing more than Steven is. And likewise, like you have to balance it. So you feel like you're both in it a fair amount. How do you do that?
Well, two things. One, quick plug. I identify as non-binary, so I'm they, them instead of she, her. No worries. And then the second thing, it's just like we got lucky we work well together. I like generally, like during the school year when I'm working, I had breaks from like 9 a.m. till 11. And that's when I would go to a Starbucks and crank out as much as I could. And Steven would wake up to like 14 texts from me because he's 2 hours behind saying, this is everything I did. Can you help with this? Or like, what do you think about this? But I think as we've kept going, it seems that like Steven's very good at being the social media guy. I'm really good at coming up with ideas, but like anyone who's met me reads my text, reads my emails. I am such a bad writer. It's like, no one should read this stuff. So generally like I'll write stuff. And I'll be like, these are my ideas, Steven. And then he writes so eloquently. And then he puts stuff on our website. So like the website in general, it was like, what are our tabs going to be? And then maybe it, like this, these two tabs I felt strongly about. So I would tell him what I thought should be there. And then he would edit everything type of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've been editing Jamie's papers since college. So.
You and like everyone else in my undergrad.
Carly, can I send you my letters of recommendation for other people for you to edit?
sure.
I need to come up with a rate, I guess.
Yeah, and to Steven too. That would be, man, yeah, my writing is, sucks.
Well, you know, a follow-up to that, as you said, you're both freelancing and, you know, I've been there. It can seem incredibly challenging sometimes to work on projects like this. While you're running from one school to another school or gigs and rehearsals. Any advice on that?
Jeez. I don't know. It's hard. It's really hard. Like, I think on my end, Texas is a minefield for gigs, which is cool. So, like, there's four different symphonies I've been able to sub with. There's always teaching opportunities, and everyone's desperate for a percussion teacher down here because drumline's so big. So, like, I was able to have a studio of 50 students last year, on top of trying to plan the Spectrum stuff, on top of taking gigs. And I have my beautiful girlfriend and her two kids. So, like, I'm doing, like, mom-dad life, too. And, like, one of the biggest things I would take away from this past year is I need to, like, prioritize myself a little bit more because, like, there were some weeks of unstable for sure. And like my priority should have been like, what do you need? As opposed to let's cram and get everything done. So like absolutely listen to yourself and your body. And like if you're not emotionally okay, take a step back before you like keep moving forward. And then two, having a goal helps. Like knowing that we were going to do that Spectrum Ensemble concert was like, oh, we have to do this. Like we're going to do this. And like if stuff came up, and I needed to say no. I started saying no to gigs because, like, we had priorities as we kept getting closer and stuff like that.
It's so good to know how to say no. I feel like people who get in that phase of life, you know, we're trained to say yes to everything and do as much as you can. You never know what will lead to a bigger opportunity or whatever. But, yeah, you say yes to everything, and all of a sudden you're spread too thin and can't do anything, one thing well, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
It really helps to just be this, like, have this partnership between the two of us. So, like, if one of us happens to be busy one week, and the other one isn't as busy that week, they can handle some things more. And then, you know, yes. like, it yes. makes it a lot easier. And also, like, we can hold each other accountable more. Mm-hmm. That's something I think Jamie is really good at, is just making sure that we know, like, what we each have to do. And then it's like, well, you got to do it now, or otherwise yeah. we're sort of letting each other down. I mean, we don't say, like, you're going to let me down if you don't do this. You know, like, it definitely makes a big difference for me, at least.
Yeah. And we have Google Drives, so many Google Drives, in terms of, like, next projects, our current projects. We had to do a GoFundMe for, like, a new light, and people asked for, it wasn't called a GoFundMe. What was it actually through?
Fundraising for Fractured Atlas. Yeah. Yes. Fractured Atlas has their own, like, little GoFundMe platform type thing.
Yeah. So we were able, we had to, like, send the CDs, we had to send the sign posters, stuff like that. So we keep track of everything on a Google Doc. And, like, one of them is called To Do. And that's, like, the summer stuff we're working on to make the next project happen in general.
I want to tell you what my Google Docs for this podcast are called. They're yes. called Etpert Casey Sketchpad. They're called Etpercussion, which is one we all have access to. There's the Google Sheet. There's This Day in Music, which is a new one. And there's a What's the Sound Google Doc. It's a mess. It's a total freaking mess.
Steven, what's ours called?
Queer Percussion World Dominance, I think.
No, I think that's Spectrum Queer World Dominance.
Spectrum Queer World Dominance. Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah. Right on. And we've actually, I was going to ask you, like, how much yours, like, was it more messy before and you sort of had to organize it? Because we definitely... We had, like, 5 million different docs within our Google Drive folder, and it was, like, just a total mess, especially leading up to our concert. By the time we got to our concert, it was, like, there was so much.
Yeah.
And we had to, like, reorganize and, like, put everything into new little neat folders and stuff, consolidate some things, because we have so many ideas, and we're, like, writing them all down, and we're, make a new doc for this. It gets messy.
Ours has gotten really, well, and you guys help me out here, but ours has gotten really messy. But I think one of those little delegated tasks is someone going and deleting it. So after today's episode, it's usually me goes in and just like, okay, we're done with that. Delete the bio, delete the Facebook questions, and try to tidy it up. But there was definitely a long stretch back then where we just didn't do anything. And it just took a while to learn, like, what we really need to put on there, what we don't need to put on there. Things that, you know, like I mentioned, my personal Google Docs. Yeah, like Ben and Carly don't need to see those. And if they do, I just cut and paste something onto the shared doc, you know. So I think, yeah, that one's pretty clean. The Google Sheet has all the scheduling and release date and who's hosting, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. I think that's about as clean as it can be, wouldn't you guys say?
It's pretty good.
Yeah, pretty professional. I bet we'll get picked up by Netflix. Hey, we do have a Facebook question. Is from Nathan Elliott Siegel. I think we talked about this a little already, but maybe not exactly this. He asks, when you started Spectrum, was it hard to find LGBTQ composers and performers to represent, or did they all emerge in mass?
I mean, I like blasted on my Facebook, like, who are my queer composers? And they like people put people's names, stuff like that. And me and Steven, because he told me this was the question, it was very easy to find, like, queer composers. It was not easy to find queer composers of color. Queer composers of any other minorities, really, was way harder to find than just
still hard
what.
To find, like,
yeah, still yeah. hard to find. We're, like, hoping to do a project with the Castillo Family Foundation, who they kind of do what we do, but for Latinx composers. Mm-hmm. And we're hoping to do some type of collaboration where we get queer Latinx composers and then maybe we perform their pieces or something like that.
Yeah, gotcha. So not too tough then.
No. Yeah. They're around.
Yeah, I mean, we have like a long list of people we are interested in working with in the future just based on like who's expressed interest and stuff. It's just a matter of choosing the next person for whatever project is coming up next.
And people have reached out. They've messaged us saying like, hey, I'm this, put me on the list. And we'll say, thank you. Please, like, so much thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I had one question to probably just sort of wrap things up here, and it's a dangerous question that we ask people sometimes. Both of you studied with Shi Yi Wu at Northwestern. Can you tell us what it was like to study with Shi Yi?
I will say that after studying with Shi Yi, like, not much is hard anymore. I've said this before. I think a lot in my driving time because my commute time is crazy. She did a really good job instilling in us that we can't do nothing. Like, one year, we all had to do a recital every year. So the freshmen do full recitals. And I don't know. I think I was doing a recital on top of applying to two competitions. And, like, I was stretched thin and nothing ended up being good. But, like, because of that, like, when I came to North Texas afterwards, I was not stressed by the amount of work they made me do, keeping up with my coursework, stuff like that. And I feel like her work ethic applies to how I do life now. Because if you're pushing forward and trying to get something done, and you know you can, like, she made us all believe that we could finish what we started, even if the quality wasn't there sometimes. But, like, I can finish a project no matter what's going on in my life. I'm, like, pretty sure of that. And I give her a lot of credit for that.
You made you tough as nails now. Yeah.
Dude. Yeah.
Well, that reminds me a lot of her. You know, I feel like she just does not slow down. It's really impressive keeping up with everything she does, you know?
You know, and there's good and bad sides to that. Like, it's taught us that we can put in that effort, but there's definitely, like, a pitfall that you can fall into of, like, not taking care of yourself. What Jamie was talking about earlier, like, we have to sort of relearn how to maintain our own mental health and, like, take time for our maintenance of ourselves, because I feel like it's in an environment like that, we learn, like, just push. Yeah. Actually, talking to Shi Yi in, like, last year, I talked to her a little bit, and she was talking about how in her life, I mean, she's still going hard, like, doing a 5 million.
Yeah.
She's had to also come back and
calm down. Yeah.
Calm down, take some more time for herself personally. Just because, like, I feel like that's an important thing, is you have to take care of yourself and your mental health and mental health.
Speaking of mental health, I just want to put this as a disclaimer out there for other students, because it's another common thing I've noticed with students. Your self-worth is not dependent on how you play.
Yes.
And that's something that's not said enough. And, like, I've seen a lot of people now, like, people my age and colleagues I talk with, it seems that, especially in, like, conservatories or, like, really, really teachers who taught old school type of ways, like, it makes sense to get on kids for not learning something. But I don't, if you're associating it with, like, you being a terrible person because you didn't learn De La Clue's One, you need to take a step back. Maybe it means you shouldn't be in percussion. Maybe it means you need to come up with actual practice techniques and stop wasting your time. I don't know. But it's not your self-worth.
Yeah. Well, my favorite technique so far to help with students who are, you know, overly critical or overly hard on themselves is to usually just, and usually you can point it to, like, hey, last week in studio class when so-and-so didn't play, say, De La Clue's One very well, do you remember that? And they're like, oh yeah, now that you mention it, I guess so. It's like, see, you would have forgotten, like, you know, like, I had to remind you it even happened, you know? So it's like, yeah, I don't know. That is so hard, you know, because it's like, it's the life pursuit you want to do and you want to be good at it. And yeah, so much of yourself is attached to it, and you have to constantly show them, like, hey, not everyone is, like, everyone who's, quote, made it is, like, still trying to make it. They're still trying to fix stuff. They're still trying to get better. And also, there's a lot of stuff they can't play too.
I have one last thing to say before we wrap up. And this is just for, like, all LGBTQ people in a role of, like, authority. Like, if you're a teacher, if you're a tech for drum corps kids and stuff like that. I personally think, and this is something, I'm on PAS Diversity. We tried to come up with a hashtag last year. And, like, the biggest one we came up with is Representation Matters. Mm-hmm. So, like, if you are a person where you get to be in front of children or in front of students, and if you're gay or if like your niche or how you identify, wear it proudly, because kids need to see that it's fine. There are still so many people out there who say it's like not okay to be gay. And like being in a situation with a family and kids now, I get it so often. There are so many microaggressions. And if you're in a position where you can make three kids feel like they're worthy, they're normal, they're like, it's worth it. The amount of kids who have come out to me over the past 2 years is overwhelming, but I know that they thought I was a safe person to have this conversation with. And like last weekend, a girl said, "Hey, I think I'm bi and I want to come out to my mom. What should I do?" And I was like, "Girl, I have no idea. I came out to my mom on her birthday and absolutely ruined her birthday." You know what I mean? But like, just do what feels right. There is not going to be a good time, but like, congratulations on figuring this out for yourself, because anyone who is queer knows that it's like this moment, or maybe not. Some people figure it out right away, but like, I didn't know because I was deep in that closet of denial. And the more people you can see representing who you are, the easier life we're creating for the next generation. So if you're gay, fly those flags, baby, because the kids need to see it.
Yeah, well said. That's great. Yeah. Yeah. What do you recommend that someone like myself does, like just a straight white male who is with students, you know, like what can we do?
So one thing, and it's cute because my dad, he's a banker, and they do a bunch of diversity specific to LGBTQ. So a lot of the stuff he tells me is where I'm getting my information on how to help people. Mm-hmm. And so one thing that he recently said that I totally agree with is in your sign off, like from emails, if you put your pronouns in there, like him, he, it shows you're an ally automatically, that you respect people's pronouns, she, her, they, them. If they're trans, they now know you are open to the trans community and stuff like that. I think just like, oh, this is a queer composer, like just mentioning references to things that are gay. Play some of the music we got commissioned for the last concert, and spotlight the fact that it's on the queer, like it's for queer people. I don't know, Steven, do you have anything else?
Yeah, I don't know. There's just like lots of little ways like that. It's not like you have to always be like, "I'm pro gay." Like if you're gay, come out to me or something, you know, like you can just be open to it in all these small ways, just that come up in everyday life. Like if there's something that comes up, don't not talk about it just because it's not relevant or something.
Yeah.
Ooh, well, thanks so much to both Jamie and Steven for a great discussion today. And thanks to Carly and Casey as well. And we will see you in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
All right, bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye, everybody.